There's something on this ship that's so bad the TARDIS ran away.
Yes.
Then we go and kick its ass!
New teeth. That's weird. So where was I? Oh, that's right. The Doctor Who podcast.
Welcome one and all to episode 363 of the Doctor Who podcast. I'm joined this week by Brent and Michelle. Hello, guys.
Hello.
Hello.
And the three of us have just finished watching Wild Blue Yonder. The credits are literally just left our screens and we've jumped on the computers so we can bring you this highly unofficial review. We need to point out, guys, that we're not the official Doctor Who podcast. Despite the fact our numbers last week in terms of people who tuned in to listen after the Star Beast probably rivaled the official Doctor Who podcast. It was the most listened to DWP in the history of time. So, congratulations, even though neither of you were on that episode.
Oh, well, yeah, that's a lovely way to start. Yeah. But in all honesty, we do welcome the new listeners. Mm-hmm. It's great to have you with us in the camper van.
What we will ask right at the very beginning is for all you new listeners, since we have so many of you now, to leave a comment or a rating on iTunes or Apple Podcasts or whatever that's called now. So it's something that we very rarely ask for. But if you want to rant, rave, celebrate, send us great amounts of praise, then that's the most public forum and the best way for you to do that. Right, I suppose we shouldn't really prevaricate much more. Where are we? 1.5 minutes so far of introductions. I'm going to get straight into it. Brent, what did you think of Wild Blue Yonder?
I loved it. Really loved it. It was really intense. It was basically a two-hander for the majority of the episode, or four, I guess. But I loved the big surprise in there, you know, with the other Doctor and the other Donna. They've set that up really well. You really thought there were two different scenes going on, like they were just cutting back and forth, and then you realize it's going on at the same time. That was really cool. But yeah, I really loved it.
Well, I don't know that I am as ecstatic about it as Brent seems to be, but I did enjoy it. I thought it was a good episode. David Tennant and Catherine Tate are such a good double act that I didn't have any trouble enjoying watching them take this story on solo, whether they were playing themselves or their other selves. But I was entertained by the mystery that was throughout. And so, yeah, I enjoyed it in a little bit more of a story of the week kind of way than last week's. But definitely worth watching, definitely enjoyed. And you, James?
Yeah, well, I think unlike last week where we were universally positive or at least on the same page, I'm not sure this time. I get what you mean, Michelle, but I found it interesting there that you opened your comments talking about the character beats as opposed to the story when we've just seen the most bizarre, unusual novel story in Doctor Who since probably Midnight. And I would gravitate towards those elements of the story first as well, because I will watch David Tennant and Catherine Tate interact as the Doctor and Donna, regardless of any plot, of any setting. And I think the format of this episode, it veered wildly from the pre-credit sequence in tone all the way to pretty much the coda at the end with Wilf. So you had... I mean, the range here is phenomenal. And I think the only reason why that works so well is because of those two leads. The story, I could take or leave, I must say. And I think I'd probably leave it because I found it slow and slightly reminiscent of the experimental Sylvester McCoy stories. not knowing what the heck is going to happen next. I remember watching The Greatest Show of the Galaxy thinking, oh my God, what on earth is this? And again, I can look back and I enjoy that now. But I don't think I'll be rushing to watch it again. I wasn't overly intrigued by this slow bomb plot that became apparent or explained almost exclusively through exposition. I didn't feel overwhelmingly negative towards it. And I love the way it looked. Probably the best looking non-terrestrial episode of Doctor Who we've seen in a very, very long time. Spaceships are amazing. Mm-hmm. The vehicles were great. The humour, which was usually juxtapositioned against some really bizarre or quite horrific imagery, worked really well. But overall, I must say, I'm kind of left a bit confused. I had a text from Phil straight afterwards, along with another one from my dad. And it's funny, actually. I'm sorry, Phil, but you were very similar to my dad, which was like, what a bizarre, strange episode of Doctor Who. And I think you'll find, not wishing to spoil anyone, that Phil did not enjoy this. But I can see opinion being divided massively on this occasion. Did I prefer last week's and the Star Beast? Infinitely more. Mm-hmm. Infinitely more. I just liked everything about that kind of story more than this. But I can imagine RTD had a great time writing this.
This was not as scary or as creepy as I had set myself up for based on the comments that we had heard from RTD ahead of time, implying that maybe this was going to be too intense for children. And while there's certainly body horror, I didn't feel like this, you know, was anywhere near as scary as I had been set up for, which is why it feels to me a little bit more like a story of the week than, I mean, it's it still feels like Doctor Who. I really like the idea that they're at the very edge of the universe, or even maybe beyond the edge of the universe out there where there is nothing. So that, you know, that sci-fi element in there was intriguing. The way the ship kept reconfiguring itself was intriguing. I'm not sure we actually got an explanation for why the ship was reconfiguring itself now that I think about it. I mean, somehow a part of it, I don't know if it was having to reconfigure itself so that the bomb would work. Maybe the self-destruct.
It changed. I understand what was going on. It changed every time you went down a number. So 10, 9, 8. Yeah, so it reconfigured and it was doing it slowly. What I didn't understand was why it was set up to do it slowly.
Oh, well, that was because the creatures were able to get a lead on whatever it was they were trying to figure out only when it happened fast. These creatures did not understand the concept of slow, which is why the Doctor and Donna tried to slow down their thinking and their body when they were face-to-face with them behind the glass. Right. Another glass. This Doctor seems to be separated from others by glass an awful lot.
I think it was the same glass, incidentally, as the previous episode. I think they just used it again.
But at any rate, the slowness, there was a good plot reason for why things had to be slow.
I'm happy there. and also, I got an answer, a kind of answer, although I think it was turned on its head again afterwards, to my question last week, which was, how does Donna know about the 10th Doctor's future? Because there was a couple of references in the episodes last week to, oh, this face has come back. Why has it come back? And how on earth does Donna know all about this? And we had a bit of a chat on our WhatsApp group about that. And Brent, I very much liked your explanation that I don't know whether it was yours, actually, or whether Drew said it and you agreed with it.
It was me, I think.
It was you. Go on, you explain what you told me.
That the meta crisis was like an ongoing thing. So even though it was subconscious, it was still feeding her information. And this fake Donna knew that and admitted it. As soon as that happened, I thought about you and I was like, oh.
Yeah. And, see, James, it wasn't poor writing.
No, I never suggested it was. I just said I'd like to know why. I was quite pleased that I caught that, really.
Right. And then at the end, the real Donna says that she doesn't remember, but either she does or she doesn't subconsciously. Who knows?
I think it's both. After today's episode, I think in the moment within the Starbeast, when she's asking the Doctor, why did this face come back, she is aware of what's going on. And now she isn't aware of what's going on, but she has some kind of residual memory. So it's quite difficult to keep track of what her current awareness level is.
And I think what Brent is suggesting, and I like the idea, is that she may still be aware of that. She's just wanting the Doctor to open up to her and work through it that way. We don't know. Maybe she genuinely doesn't remember at this point, but I think the possibility, I think, is written ambiguously enough that Donna may remember.
I'm not sure it is ambiguous. I think there are times when she does remember and there are times when she doesn't. Whether or not it's Donna using that knowledge in a, dare I say, strategic way to manage her relationship with the Doctor or not, I think that might be too much. I just think in moments of stress where the Metacrisis energy was everywhere in the Starbeast, she is fully aware of what's going on, whereas this week she wasn't, but the alien version of her was.
Well, Brent and I may disagree. There are times when, as a mother, you let the one you're caring for, work it out for themselves, even if you know better.
I don't think I'm that patient, that's all. Talking of offspring, Natasha watched this as well, along with Angela. And I'd like to just put that into context with the body horror comment you made earlier, Michelle. And in a way, I can see what they were trying to achieve with the long arms and the bodies getting larger and chasing them down a corridor. And I can see the intention there is to create some kind of horrific image, you know, or imagery, and make you feel uncomfortable. And I think that's what a lot of the reviews or previews that journalists had written focused on. But for me, it didn't really work. It came across as a bit silly instead. And Natasha was killing herself with laughter. Because her gut instinct was, this is ludicrous. It didn't cross her mind that it was vaguely horrific.
Yeah, and that's what I'm saying. I don't think it was as traumatic or traumatizing as maybe it was presented. It still felt like Doctor Who to me. Doctor Who, you know, has always been scary in some elements. And I didn't think this was outside of what the norm is for Doctor Who.
Yeah, Doctor Who has never scared me. But it has creeped me out here and there over the 60 years that it's been on. So, like, Image of the Fen Doll is creepy. Some parts of Horror Fang Rock is creepy. And then in this one, when they're talking and all of a sudden the Doctor's jaw drops to the floor, and I was like, oh, that's weird. And I could see that it looks a little silly, but I was really intense on this. I was really focusing. And then when that happened, it sort of threw me for a second. And I was like, ooh, that was a bit creepy. And the way Donna, Catherine Tate is such a good actress. And when they're standing behind the screen and they're looking, or behind the glass, I mean, and they're looking at the other Doctor and Donna, if you watch her face, she just has this evil look on her face that you've never seen before on Donna. And it's like, wow. But I really enjoyed it.
This episode, if you are a writer and you know you are really fortunate in having another bite of the cherry, you've got David Tennant and Catherine Beck coming back, then you're going to write a script that's going to show off their talents. And Catherine Tate in particular is fantastic at the comedy, the timing that's widely acknowledged as the most difficult and tricky kind of acting to get correct. But also to move over to her serious, menacing, quite scary looks like that. I just think it was incredible, because you're right, it was really quite horrific. And I actually think Tennant shone this time as well. And trying to act against yourself, I would imagine, is challenging at the best of times. But I wonder what they thought when they actually saw this back. Because just to put yourself in that position, if you were watching a film like this and you're in it, and there's two of you, and there's one of you that looks really evil, and then bits of your anatomy start expanding. I mean, that must be a bizarre experience that only they are going to know what it feels like.
Well, I want to expand a little bit on kind of what we started with, which is how much I am enjoying the character beats for this version of the Doctor and Donna together. It's just extraordinary. He seems to be one of the most tender incarnations of the Doctor that we've ever seen. I mean, that whole sequence where Donna has the anxiety about not being able to get home, and he kisses her hand. Later on, he kisses her head. Holds her hand to his chest, and there's just, even while he still doesn't want to open up about his own feelings and trauma, he just seems to be so much more emotionally accessible to the characters around him, which, you know, again, every Doctor needs to be different, but I'm enjoying this take on the Doctor.
I like the distinction from the 10th, and I kind of want to say, oh, I wonder if it's intentional, but I'm sure it is. There has to be a distinction between the two personas. And I agree. I think Tennant pulls it off brilliantly. And maybe I read too much into this, but it's a similar trait, I think, that Whittaker showed in her portrayal, where she could be incredibly empathetic in the moment without ever getting into the detail. And that's precisely what Tennant did in this story, whereas he was very supportive to Donna throughout and very understanding, more so than a 10th Doctor would have been. And yet when it gets to the detail and the stuff that he was involved in that really bothered him, when he talked about the flux, we haven't talked about that yet, and also the discussion with the fake Donna about his origins, then all of that, that's new, real new stuff that, again, I find real value as a watcher in just experiencing that. And I like that very much, because they could have just played it really straight and done three more series four stories, which again, some of the more snarkier comments suggested the Star Beast was just a continuation of season four, which I don't agree with. But this particular 60-minute episode or thereabouts, I think, shows the character, the unique traits of the 14th Doctor, which I think is great. I did think it went on a long, long time. I looked at my watch on at least two or three occasions here, thinking, is this just going to be the story for like the best part of 40 minutes, 45 minutes? And it was. They just went through various motions, really, or various different parts of this beautiful spaceship.
Yeah, it was. That spaceship looked incredible. And it was actually shorter than last week's episode by about 3 or 4 minutes.
You're talking about the episode or the actual spaceship? Because I'd say last week's was shorter than this one.
I love the ship. For me, one of the most exciting parts was the ending when he picked up the wrong Donna. And I really thought she might die, especially she looks down at the corridor and there's this big fireball coming. And you're like, oh no, is that the fake Donna that's in the giggle next week? And what's going on? And thankfully he figured it out and came and rescued her. But that was intense.
It made me wonder whether Michelle's prediction was going to come true this week as well. I was pretty certain Tate would have been in it next week as well. And I can't imagine that they would have had a fake Donna for the finale or the last episode.
We could still kill her off next week. Hey, I have one more question, a plot point that I didn't understand.
And you're going to ask us?
Yeah, well, I live in hope.
Good luck.
Wild Blue Yonder, the TARDIS was playing Wild Blue Yonder. Did we ever figure out why the TARDIS was playing? I mean, they had a lot of conversation about the song, but why was the TARDIS playing Wild Blue Yonder?
I thought it had to do with the HADS system. That was kind of warning them that they were going into danger. So, like, it's a war song about going into danger, going into war. And maybe the TARDIS was its way of saying, you're going into danger, I'm out of here. And it left, maybe.
Instead of the cloister bell.
Yeah. Just a guess.
that's new. Hey, but Brent comes up with the best explanations.
I think it had something to do with the pre-credit sequence with Isaac Newton. I'm not sure precisely what, because a lot of the dialogue at the beginning of the episode was incredibly fast, and having only seen this once on a TV, I didn't catch it all. In fact, I did try to turn on the subtitles about halfway through because I was missing a lot of the dialogue, and I think a lot of the explanation concerning that part was lost to me, at least. So I'm maybe I'll pick it up on a rewatch. There was two areas that I wanted to discuss before we move on to some immediate feedback. First of all, we saw the first couple of scenes at the end of the episode in the TARDIS. I'm not sure how I feel about this anymore, or not as clearly as I did last week. All the images I've seen of it online, I've thought, wow, what an incredible version of the TARDIS. Yet it felt like they were just discussing stuff in a cavernous conference room.
Yeah,
really. You know, it just felt that there wasn't much in it. You know, it didn't feel as though it was like a cozy, safe place that a TARDIS has always felt in the past. And again, it wasn't a deep feeling, but I was aware of thinking that towards.
Yeah, it didn't
the
have all the bells and whistles that it did last week. You kind of see some of it when they land on top of the tree at the beginning. You see the little red circles in there. The roundels. And then later on, it's just they're talking and it's kind of like a grayish white background. And last week it was so colorful and everything. It reminded me of the new sphere that's in Las Vegas. What it reminded me of. It was really cool. And when this one started and it just blew out fire, and he looked inside and said, "Uh-oh." And I thought, surely we're not going to get Shooty's TARDIS now. And it came back exactly the same, so.
It was brand new.
Yeah.
For everybody who's ever had a new car and had something happen to it right after. Right after you sign on the dotted line. But I wasn't bothered. I still love it. We just weren't in it very much this time. I was glad it didn't get destroyed.
I didn't think they could possibly build something that grandiose or that large and then literally use it for a single scene. I thought that would have been extremely unlikely, or even just three episodes. So Shooty is clearly going to get this version of the TARDIS, even if they give it a spruce up, as they've done in the past. And we know for sure that the titles, for example, are going to be updated as well, but not completely changed. So I think we're going to see a lot of that in the next series. And last thing I wanted to ask about was the opening scene, which I must say, I think is probably the most enjoyable part of the episode for me, with Isaac Newton and the TARDIS spinning from the horizon into the tree, and a whole load of apples fell on top of Isaac Newton. I thought that was great. I liked that a lot.
Well, it was a cute scene, but I didn't really understand how it tied into the others or why they kept saying Mavity. Are we supposed to take from that something significant happened, that history was changed in some way? And apparently Isaac Newton had a hard time hearing them too, James, because they certainly said gravity. So maybe it isn't just you, but, you know, it was all right. It was fun, you know, the whole bit about recalibrating what's the year. and the apple tree was all fun, but I was kind of surprised. Again, just wondering whether we're supposed to take something away from the fact that they kept saying Mavity.
I think it's possible, and it could be a change in history somewhere along
maybe,
the line.
Maybe that's why the ending, the Earth, maybe whatever they did is the reason that we had the trouble at the end. Okay.
Yeah, that's... Yeah.
And leading into the ending, of course, we saw Wilf, and I expected us to see Wilf next week, and I fully expect Wilf. I mentioned this briefly last week, and that thought has developed over the last 7 days or so, but I fully expect Wilf to be the reason why the 14th Doctor has to regenerate into the 15th, or into Shooty Gatwa, because he did it before, and Wilf will do it again.
I was surprised to see him show up at the end. I fully expected him to be on next week, and when he showed up, it got me. I got a little tear in the eye. I was like, oh, look. And then they did the tribute at the end.
Which I didn't see. I must say, I didn't
see.
Oh,
you didn't?
No. Again, watching with Angela and Tasha, I don't get to read the credits. So.
I'm just curious about whether there's going to be another glass panel.
Do you know what? I might put that down as this week's kooky theory of the week. The mysterious glass panel that appears in all three episodes.
That is following, never mind fate or destiny, this 14th Doctor is being followed by glass panels.
The visual representation of a transparent plot point. You can see right through it. Right, okay, let's move on to some feedback we've received on X. And again, in no particular order, Matt BS. I was a bit disappointed. All the secrecy hinted at a bigger story, but then there were the last few minutes, .. which is, not a million miles away from the way I feel. Joseph Carey, it was amazing and had elements of Midnight, Heaven Sent, and The Mind Robber, with the wrong Donna being chosen by the Doctor. What a great analogy.
Yes, indeed.
Morgs says that was barking mad. I rather enjoyed it. George Stevens, if that had been a classic Who episode, nothing happened in the first one. Not sure I understand that one, George.
Oh, I think maybe he means, well, I don't know, if it had been two episodes instead of one. I don't know.
Yeah. Never mind. You'll have to clarify your tweet there, please, George. Thank you. And the last one for now, Mick Miners, your host with the most, who got in contact prior to broadcast, said that they thought this episode, or the publicity surrounding it, they commented on it saying, I think we're delving into the Doctor's timeless child origins. And of course, that was referred to. And we knew from RTD that he wasn't going to retcon all of Chibnall's era, but I think this will probably be the closest we're going to get to going into the timeless child.
The less said, the better.
Yeah, I tend to agree.
Although I thought it was handled very well. I thought that conversation was brilliant. Fascinating. Yeah. Where, you know, what turned out to be the false Donna was pushing him about how he really feels about his origins. So, and I also appreciate that there was an acknowledgement that half the universe got destroyed, because that was just kind of ignored. Remember, we all finished Flux going, wait a minute.
That's true, yeah. But I have a feeling it was 3/4, not 50%. I need to go back and check, because I want to know the correct percentage.
Hey, I've got a few comments from Facebook where listeners also have been responding very quickly. Eddie Coates Madden says, well, if last week's was great, this was a step up again. Brilliant episode. So moving to see Bernard Cribbins, too. So there's definitely a two thumbs up one. Chris Rolton says, Midnight, but with slightly cartoony CGI. I genuinely hope that everybody else really enjoyed it, but it didn't feel great to me. And then finally, Matthew Paveley, after watching it, I don't really get what all the secrecy was about. Okay episode with a brilliant cliffhanger, but still just a very standard stuck on a spaceship episode.
Yeah, I think there was a lot of expectation for returning characters, monsters, whatever. And the director, and I can't recall who it is who directed, posted something earlier on this week to say, we just thought it would be fun to hide a plot, you know, so that people came into this fresh and cold. And I have to say, there was very little information about this episode online, despite RTD's approach to marketing and branding.
Yeah, and it's Tom Kingsley. Thank you. Yeah. Was the director.
So he was telling the truth. He wasn't trying to hide anything.
Right. There were a couple of trolls online on Twitter that were posting pictures of Peter Capaldi and saying, ooh, look who might show up this week. And so I was like, I was angry when I was going in. I was like, I hope they didn't blow it. But they didn't. He wasn't there. Yeah, just more trolls.
I do wonder if we're going to get any kind of celebratory aspect of Doctor Who in the final special. So, You know, if there are going to be cameos, then it's going to be in a final special, isn't it? Probably. So we'll wait and see.
Well, that's it for us this week. If you have any thoughts or feedback, send it to us at feedback@thedoctorwhopodcast.com, on Twitter or X at @thedrwhopodcast, on our Facebook group. And also, you can tune into the latest Who & Company episode that just dropped yesterday for Michelle. She appeared on our show talking about Loki and other things, such as driving Richard Franklin to pizza in her mom's station wagon. That's a really cool story.
And where can they find that, Brent?
Libsyn.whoandcompany.com.
Brilliant.
I can't imagine why anybody else would want to listen to more Michelle. However, hopefully we will be back with some of the other part of the Doctor Who podcast contingent later this week for a more considered take on Wild Blue Yonder. Meanwhile, we certainly look forward to your feedback. And as always here at the Doctor Who podcast, you are most welcome.
Thanks for tuning in. Bye for now.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
That was the Doctor Who podcast with your hosts, Brent, Michelle, and James. You can find us at thedoctorwhopodcast.com. If you have any feedback, please send it in to feedback@thedoctorwhopodcast.com. You can also find us on Twitter and Facebook. Thank you for listening, and take care.
yonder. Let's go sailing in the wild blue yonder. Let's go sailing in the wild blue yonder. Packing it up, leaving it all behind. Let's go loving like we know we ought to. Let's go loving like we know we ought to.
And what I-